Chapter 61. Crozier.
My man, he shouts.
But he is too weak to shout it. He is too weak to say it out loud. He is too weak even to remember what the two syllables mean.
My man, he cries again.
It emerges as a moan. She is torturing him. Crozier does not awaken all at once, but rather comes awake through a series of painful attempts to open his eyes, stitching together separate tatters of attempted awareness, stretching over hours and even days, always propelled up out of death sleep by pain and by the two empty syllables, my men, until he is at last conscious enough to remember who he is and to see where he is and to realize who he is with. She is torturing him. The Eskimo girl woman he had known as Lady Silence keeps cutting into his chest, arms, side, back and leg with a sharp, heated knife. The pain is incessant and intolerable. He is lying near her in a small space. Not a snow house as John Irving had described to Crozier, but some sort of tent made of skins stretched over curved sticks or bones, with flickering light from several small oil lamps illuminating the girl's bare upper body. And when he looks down, Crozier's own bare and torn and bleeding chest and arms and belly. He thinks she must be slicing him into small strips. Crozier tries to scream, but finds again that he is too weak to scream. He tries to bat her torturing arm and knife hand away, but he is too weak to lift his own arm, much less stop hers. Her brown eyes stare into his, acknowledging that he is alive again, and then return to studying the damage her knife is doing as she cuts and slashes and tortures him. Crozier manages the weakest of moans. Then he falls away into darkness, but not back into dream listening and the pleasant no-self which he now only half remembers, but only into black wave surges in a sea of pain. She feeds him some sort of broth from one of the emptied goldener tins she must have stolen from Terra. The broth tastes of some sea animal's blood. She then cuts strips of seal meat and blubber, using a strange curved blade with an ivory handle, holding the slab of seal in her teeth and slicing dangerously close to her lips as she cuts downward, then chews the pieces well, finally pressing them between Crozier's chapped and torn lips. He tries to spit them out. He does not want to be fed like some baby bird, but she retrieves each fatty blob and presses it back into his mouth. Defeated, unable to fight her, he finds the energy to chew and swallow. Then he falls back to sleep, to the lullaby of howling wind, but is soon awakened. He realizes that he is naked between furred sleeping robes. His clothes, all his many layers, are not in the little tent space, and that she has rolled him onto his belly now, setting some sort of smooth sealskin beneath him to keep the blood from his lacerated chest from soiling the soft hides and furs that cover the tent floor. She is cutting and probing his back with a long, straight blade. Too weak to resist or roll over, all Crozier can do is moan. He imagines her slicing him to pieces and then cooking and eating the pieces. He feels her pressing strands of something moist and slimy onto and into the many wounds in his back. At some point in the torture, he falls asleep again.
My man!
It is only after several days of this pain, and of slipping constantly into and out of consciousness, and of thinking that Silence is slicing him to pieces, that Crozier remembers being shot. He awakens, with the tent dark except for a tiny amount of moonlight or starlight seeping through the tight-stretched hides. The Eskimo girl is sleeping next to him, sharing his body heat even as he shares hers, and both of them are naked. Crozier feels not the slightest stir of passion or physical interest beyond his animal need for warmth. He is in too much pain.
My man. I must get back to my man. Warn them.
For the first time, he remembers Hickey, the moonlight, the gunshots. Crozier's arm is lying across his chest. And now he forces his hand to touch higher, where the shotgun pellets had struck his chest and shoulder. His upper left torso is a mass of welts and wounds, but it feels as if the shotgun pellets and any clothing driven into his flesh with them have been carefully dug out. There is something soft, like moistened moss or seaweed, pressed into the larger wounds, and while Crozier has the impulse to dig it out and throw it away, he does not have the strength. His upper back hurts even more than his lacerated chest, and Crozier remembers the torture as Silence dug there with her knife blade. He also remembers the slight squelching sound after Hickey pulled the trigger, but before the shotgun cartridges fired. The powder had been wet and old, and both shots had probably ignited with far less than full explosive force. But he can also recall the impact of the outer part of the widening pellet cloud, hurling him around, and then down onto the ice. He had been shot once from the back with the shotgun at extreme range, and once from the front.
Has the Eskimo girl dug out every pellet, every shred of filthy clothing driven into me?
Crozier blinks in the dimness. He remembers visiting Dr. Goodsir's sickbay and the surgeon's patient explanations of how, in naval warfare, as well as with most of the wounds suffered on their expedition, it was usually not the initial wound that killed, but the sepsis from the contaminated wounds that set in later. He moves his hand slowly from his chest to his shoulder. He remembers now that after the shotgun blasts, Hickey then shot him several times with Crozier's own pistol. And the first bullet had struck here. Crozier gasps as his fingers find a deep groove in the flesh of his upper biceps. It is packed with the moldy, slimy stuff. The pain of touching it makes him dizzy and ill. There is another groove from a bullet along his left rib. Touching that, just moving his hand that far exhausts him, makes him gasp aloud and black out for a moment. When some consciousness returns, Crozier realizes that Silence has dug a bullet out of his flesh there in his side and also dressed this wound with whatever heathenish poultice she had applied elsewhere on his body. Guessing from the pain when he breathes and from the soreness and swelling in his back, he thinks that this bullet broke at least one rib on his left side, was deflected, and lodged under the skin near his left shoulder blade. Silence must have extracted it from there. It takes endless minutes and the rest of his meager energy for him to lower his hand to touch his most painful wound. Crozier does not remember being shot in the left leg, but the pain from the muscle there, just above and under his knee, convinces him that a third bullet must have passed through at that point. He can feel both the entrance and exit holes under his shaking fingers. 2 inches higher, and the bullet would have taken his knee. The knee would have cost him his leg, and his leg would almost certainly have meant his life. Again, there is a poultice bandage there, and although he can feel scabs, there seems to be no fresh flow of blood.
No wonder I'm burning up from fever. I'm dying of sepsis.
Then he realizes that the heat he feels may not be fever.
These robes insulate so well, and Lady Silence's naked body next to his is pouring out so much heat that he is completely warm for the first time in... how long? Months? Years? With great effort, Crozier pushes back the top of the robe that covers both of them, allowing a little cooler air in. Silence stirs but does not waken. Staring at her in the dim light in the tent, he thinks she looks like a child, perhaps like one of his cousin Albert's younger teenaged daughters. With this thought in mind, remembering playing croquet on a green lawn in Dublin, Crozier falls asleep again. She is in her parka and kneeling in front of him, hands about a foot apart, string made of animal sinew or gut dancing between her splayed fingers and thumbs. She is using her fingers to play a cat's cradle child's game with sinew as string. Crozier watches dully. The same two patterns keep appearing out of the complicated crisscross of sinew string. The first comprises three bands of strings, creating two triangles at the top, just in from her thumbs, but with a double loop of string in the lower center of the pattern, showing a peaked dome. The second pattern, her right hand pulled far away with just two bare strings, running almost to her left hand, where the string loops around just her thumb and little finger, shows a complex little loop of doubled string that looks like a cartoon figure, with four oval legs or flippers, and a string loop head. Crozier has no idea what the forms mean. He shakes his head slowly to let her know that he does not want to play. Silence stares at him for a silent moment, her dark eyes looking into his. Then she undoes the pattern with a graceful collapse of her small hands and sets the string in the ivory bowl he drinks his broth from. A second later, she crawls out through the multiple tent flaps. Shocked by the cold air blowing in for those seconds, Crozier tries to crawl to the opening. He needs to see where he is. Background groans and crackings have suggested that they are still on the ice, perhaps very near where he was shot. Crozier has no sense of how long it has been since Hickey ambushed the four of them, himself, Good Sir, poor Lane and Goddard, but he has hopes that it has been only a few hours, a day or two at most. If he leaves now, he might still be able to get his warning to the men at rescue camp before Hickey, Manson, Thompson and Aylmore show up there to do more damage. Crozier is able to lift his head and shoulders a few inches, but is far too weak to slither out from under the robes, much less to crawl to look out through the caribou hide tent flaps. He sleeps again. Sometime later, he is not even sure if it is the same day or if Silence has come and gone several times since he fell asleep. Silence wakes him. The dim light through the hides is the same. The interior of the tent is illuminated by the same blubber lamps. There is a fresh slab of seal lying in the snowy niche in the floor she uses for storage. And Crozier sees that she has just pulled off her heavy outer parka and is wearing only some sort of short pants with the fur side turned inward. The soft outer hide is lighter in color than Silence's brown skin. Her breasts bobble as she kneels in front of Crozier again. Suddenly, the string dances between her fingers again. This time, the little animal design near her left hand is shown first. The string is loosened, retwisted, and the design of the peaked oval dome in the center comes next. Crozier shakes his head. He does not understand. Silence tosses the string into the bowl, takes her short, semicircular blade with the ivory handle, looking like the handle of a stevedore's hook, and begins slicing up the slab of seal meat.
"I have to go find my men," whispers Crozier. "You have to help me find my men."
Silence watches him. The captain does not know how many days may have elapsed since his first awakening. He sleeps much. His few waking hours are spent with him eating his broth, eating the seal meat and blubber that Silence no longer has to pre-chew for him, but which she still lifts to his lips. And with her changing his poultices and cleaning him, Crozier is mortified beyond words that his basic elimination needs must be attended to him using another Goldner's can set into the snow, reachable through a gap between the sleeping robes beneath him, and that it is this girl who regularly must carry the can out to empty it somewhere out there on the ice floes. It does not make Crozier feel any better that the contents of the can freeze quickly, and that there is almost no smell from it in the little tent that already smells so strongly of fish and seal and their own human sweat and presence.
"I need you to help me get back to my men," he rasps again.
He feels that the odds are great that they are still close to the Polynya, where Hickey ambushed them, no more than 2 miles out on the ice from rescue camp. He needs to warn the others. It confuses him that every time he awakens, the dim light through the tent's hide walls seems the same. Perhaps for some reason that only Dr. Goodsir could explain, he awakens only at night. Perhaps Silence is drugging him with her seal blood soup to keep him sleeping during the day, to keep him from escaping.
"Please," he whispers.
He can only hope that despite her muteness, the savage has learned a little English during her months aboard HMS Terra. Goodsir had confirmed that Lady Silence could hear, even if she had no tongue with which to speak, and Crozier himself had seen her start at some sudden loud noise when she was a guest on their ship. Silence continues staring at him.
"She's an idiot as well as a savage," thinks Crozier.
He would be goddamned if he'd beg this heathen native again. He would have to keep eating, keep recovering, build up his strength, shove her aside one day and walk back to camp himself. Silence blinks and turns to cook the slab of seal meat over her little blubber stove. He awakes on another day, or rather another night, since the light is as dim as always, to find Silence kneeling over him and playing her string game again. The first pattern between her fingers shows the little peaked dome shape again. Her fingers dance. 2 vertical looped shapes appear, but with 2 legs or flippers now rather than 4. She pulls her hands farther apart, and somehow the designs actually move, sliding farther from her right hand and toward her left hand, the balloon leg loops moving. She undoes that design. Her fingers fly, and the oval dome shape appears in the center again. But, Crozier slowly realizes, it is not quite the same shape. The peak of the dome is gone, and now it is a pure catenary curve, such as he studied as a midshipman, poring over geometry and trigonometry illustrations. He shakes his head.
"I don't understand," he rasps. "This game doesn't make any goddamned sense."
Silence looks at him, blinks, tosses the string into an animal hide pack, and begins to pull him out of his sleeping furs. Crozier still does not have the strength to resist, but neither does he use what little strength he has regained to help. Silence props him up and tugs a light caribou underjacket and then a thick fur parka over his upper body. Crozier is shocked to feel how light the 2 layers are. The cotton and wool layers he's worn for outside work the past 3 years weighed more than 30 pounds before they inevitably became soaked with sweat and ice. But he doubts if this upper outfit of Eskimo clothing weighs more than 8 pounds. He feels how loose both layers are on his upper body, but how snugly everything fits at the neck and wrists, tight anywhere that heat might escape. Embarrassed, Crozier does try to help pull on the light caribou pants over his nakedness. These are larger versions of the short pants that are all that Silence wears in the tent. And then the high caribou stockings, but his fingers get in the way more than not. Silence pushes his hands away and finishes dressing him with an impersonal economy of effort known only to mothers and nurses. Crozier watches as Silence pulls liners that look to be made of woven grass onto his feet and pulls them tight over his feet and ankles. Presumably, these are for insulation, and he has trouble even imagining how long it had taken her, or some woman, to weave the grass into such high, tight socks. Fur boots, when tugged on over his grass socks by Silence, overlap his fur stocking pants, and he notices that the soles of these boots are made of the thickest hides of any of their clothing. During the first hours he'd been awake in the tent, Crozier had wondered at the profusion of robes, parkas, furs, caribou hides, pots, sinew, the seal oil lamps made of what looked to be soapstone, the curved cutting knife and other tools. But then he realized the obvious. It had been Lady Silence who had looted the bodies and packs of the 8 dead Eskimo killed by Lieutenants Hodgson and Farr. The rest of the material, Goldner tins, spoon, extra knife, marine mammals' ribs, pieces of wood, ivory, even what looked to be old barrel staves now used as part of the tent framework, must have been scavenged from Terra or the abandoned Terra camp, or during Silence's months alone on the ice. When he is dressed, Crozier collapses onto one elbow and pants.
"Are you taking me back to my people now?" he asks.
Silence pulls mittens over his hands, flips his hood with its white bear fur trim up over his head, firmly grips the bearskin beneath him, and drags him outside through the tent flaps. The cold air hits Crozier's lungs and makes him cough, but after a moment he realizes how warm the rest of his body feels. He can feel his own body heat flowing up and around him within the roomy confines of this obviously non-porous garment. Silence bustles around him for a minute, pulling him up into a sitting position on a pile of folded furs. He guesses that she does not want him lying on the ice, even on the bearskin, since it feels warmer in these strange Eskimo clothes when one sits up and lets air warmed by one's own body heat circulate against the skin. As if to confirm this theory, Silence whisks away the bearskin on the ice and folds it, adding it to the stack next to the one he's sitting on. Astonishingly, Rosia's feet have been cold every time he has ever gone up on deck or out onto the ice in the past 3 years, and have been wet and cold for every minute since he left Terra. Neither the cold of the ice here, nor moisture, seems to penetrate the thick hide soles and grass booties he's wearing now. As Silence begins taking down the tent with a few sure movements, Crozier looks around him. It is night.
"Why has she brought me out here at night? Is there some emergency?"
The caribou tent quickly being dismantled is, as he guessed from the noises, out on the pack ice, set amid seracs and icebergs and pressure ridges that reflect the little starlight thrown by the few stars peeking between low clouds. Crozier sees the dark water of a Polynya not 30 feet from where he'd been lying in the tent, and his heart beats faster.
"We've not left the area where Hickey ambushed us, not 2 miles from rescue camp. I know the way back from here."
Then he realizes that this Polynya is far smaller than the one Robert Golding had led them to. This patch of open, black water is less than 8 feet long and only half that wide. Nor do the surrounding icebergs frozen into the pack ice here look right. They are much taller and more numerous than those near Hickey's ambush site, and the pressure ridges are taller. Crozier squints at the sky, catching only glimpses of stars. If the clouds would part, and if he had his sextant and tables and a chart, he might be able to fix his position.
If. Might.
The only recognizable patch of stars he catches sight of look more like a winter constellation than one that should be in that part of the Arctic sky in mid or late August. He knows that he was shot on the night of 17 August. He had already made his daily log entry before Robert Golding had come running into camp, and he cannot imagine that more than a few days have passed since the ambush. He looks wildly around the ice-jumbled horizons, trying to find a twilight glow that would hint of a recent sunset or imminent sunrise in the south. There is only the night and the howling wind and the clouds and a few trembling stars.
Dear Christ, where is the sun?
Crozier is still not cold, but he is trembling and shaking so badly that he has to use what little strength he has to grip the pile of folded furs to keep from toppling over. Lady Silence is doing a very strange thing. She has collapsed the hide and bone tent in a few efficient motions. Even in the dim light, Crozier can see that the outer tent covers are made of sealskins, and now kneels on one of the sealskin tent covers and uses her half-moon blade to slice it down the middle. Then she hauls the two halves of the sealskin to the polynia and, using a curved stick to lower the pieces into the water, thoroughly wets them. Returning to the site where the tent stood only moments ago, she pulls frozen fish from the storage area that had been cut into the ice in her half of the tent and briskly lays a line of fish, head to tail, along one side of each half of the quickly freezing tent cover. Crozier has not the slightest clue as to what the wench is up to. It is as if she is performing some insane heathenish religious ritual out here in the rising night wind under the stars. But the problem is, Crozier sees, she has cut up their sealskin tent cover. Even if she rebuilds the tent from hides stretched over the scattered curved sticks and ribs and bones, it will no longer hold out the wind and cold. Ignoring him, Silence rolls both halves of the sealskin tent cover tightly around the two lines of fish, pulling and tugging the wet sealskin to make it even tighter. It amuses Crozier that she has left half of one fish protruding from one end of both lengths of rolled sealskin. And now she concentrates on bending upward the head end of each fish, ever so slightly. In 2 minutes, she can lift the 2 7-foot-long lengths of sealskin-wrapped fish, each now frozen as solidly as a long, narrow piece of oak with a rising fish head at its tip, and she lays them parallel on the ice. Now she sets a small hide under her knees and kneels to use bits of sinew and hide thongs to lash short lengths of caribou antlers and ivory, the former frame to the tent, to connect the 2 7-foot-long wrapped fish lengths.
Mother of God, rasps Francis Crozier. The frozen lengths of fish wrapped in wet sealskin are runners. The antlers are crosspieces. You're building a fucking sledge, he whispers.
His breath hangs as crystals in the night air, as his bemusement turns to a sort of panic.
It wasn't this cold on 17 August, and before. Nowhere near this cold, even in the middle of the night.
Crozier guesses that it has taken Silence half an hour, or less, to make the fish runner caribou antler sledge. But now he sits on his stack of furs for another hour and a half or more, gauging the passage of time is difficult without his pocket watch, and because he keeps drifting off into a light sleep, even while sitting, as the woman works on the runners of the sledge. First, she removes something that looks like a mixture of mud and moss from a canvas bag that had come from Terra. Carrying goldener cans of water from the polynia, she shapes this mud moss into fist-sized balls, and then lays these daubs the length of the ad hoc runners, patting and spreading them evenly with her bare hands. Crozier has no clue why her hands do not freeze solid, despite her frequent breaks to stick her hands under her parka against her own bare belly. Silence smooths the frozen mud with her knife, trimming it as a sculptor might cut his clay maquette. Then she brings more water from the polynia and pours it over the frozen layer of mud, creating an ice shoeing. Finally, she sprays mouthfuls of water onto a strip of bearskin and rubs that wet fur up and down the frozen mud along the length of each runner until the coating of ice there is absolutely smooth. In the starlight, it looks to Crozier as if the runners along the inverted sledge, just fish and strips of sealskin 2 hours earlier, are lined with glass. Silence rights the sledge, tests the thongs and knots, puts her weight on the firmly lashed caribou antlers and short pieces of wood, and lashes the remaining antlers, two longer curved ones that had been the primary tent supports, up from the rear of the sledge to make rudimentary handles. Then she lays several layers of sealskins and bearskins across the cross antlers and comes to lift Crozier to his feet and help him over to the sledge. He shakes off her arm and tries to walk to it by himself. He has no memory of collapsing face first into the snow, but his vision and hearing return as Silence is lifting him onto the sledge, straightening his legs, setting his back firmly against piled furs stacked against the rear antler handles, and setting several thick robes over him. He sees that she has tied long strips of leather to the front of the sledge and woven the ends into a sort of harness that goes around her middle. He thinks of her finger-string games and sees what she had been saying. The tent, peaked oval, taken down. The two of them leaving, the walking figures in the sliding bits of string, although Crozier certainly was not walking this night, to another oval dome with no peak. Another tent, in the shape of a dome. A snow house? With everything packed, the extra furs and canvas bags and hide-wrapped pots and seal oil lamps all lying atop and around Crozier, Silence slips into harness and begins pulling them across the ice. The runners glide with a glassy efficiency, far more silently and smoothly than the boat sledges from Terra and Erebus. Crozier is shocked to discover that he is still warm. 2 hours or more of just sitting still out on the ice floe has not chilled him, except for the tip of his nose. The clouds are solid overhead. There is no hint of sunrise on the horizon in any direction. Francis Crozier has absolutely no hint as to where the woman is taking him. Back to King William Island? South to the Adelaide Peninsula? Toward Back's River? Farther out onto the ice? "My men," he rasps at her. He strains to raise his voice and be heard over the wind sigh, snow hiss, and the groaning of the thick ice beneath them. "I need to get back to my men. They're looking for me. Miss. Ma'am. Lady Silence. Please. For the love of God. Please. Take me back to rescue camp." Silence does not turn. He can see only the back of her hood and the white bear ruff gleaming in the faint starlight. He has no idea how she can see to proceed in this darkness, or how such a small girl can pull his weight and the sledge's weight so easily. They glide silently into the darkness of the ice jumble ahead. Chapter 62. Crozier. Sedna, at the bottom of the sea, decides whether to send the seal up to the surface to face being hunted by other animals and the real people. But in a real sense, it is the seal himself who decides whether to allow himself to be killed or not. In another real sense, there is only one seal. Seals are like real people, in that they each have two spirits. A life spirit that dies with the body, and a permanent spirit that departs the body at the time of death. This longer-lasting soul, the Tarnik, hides in the seal as a tiny bubble of air and blood that a hunter can find in the seal's gut and is the same shape as the seal itself, only much smaller. When a seal dies, its permanent spirit departs and returns in exactly the same form in a baby seal, descended from the seal who has decided to allow itself to be taken and eaten. The real people know that a hunter, over his lifetime, will be capturing and killing the same seal or walrus or bear or bird many times over. Precisely the same thing happens to the permanent spirit of a member of the real people when his life spirit dies with the body. The Inua, the permanent spirit soul, travels, with all of its memories and skills intact, only hidden to a boy or girl in the line of the dead person's family. This is one of the reasons that the real people never discipline their children, no matter how rowdy or even impertinent they may become. Besides the child soul in that child, there resides an adult's Inua, a father, uncle, grandfather, great-grandfather, mother, aunt, grandmother, or great-grandmother, with all its hunters and matriarchs or shamans' wisdom, and it should not be rebuked. The seal will not yield itself up to just any real people hunter. The hunter must win them over, not just through his guile and stealth and skill, but also through the quality of the hunter's own courage and Inua. These Inua, the spirits of the real people, seals, walruses, bears, caribou, birds, whales, existed as spirits before the earth, and the earth is old. During the first period of the universe, the earth was a floating disk beneath a sky supported by four pillars. Beneath the earth was a dark place where the spirits lived, and where most live to this day. This early earth was underwater most of the time and without any human beings. The real people, or others, until two men, Akulu Jusi and Umanirtuk, crawled out of humps in the earth. These two became the first of the real people. There were no stars in that era, no moon, no sun, and the two men and their descendants had to live and hunt in total darkness. Since there were no shamans to guide the real people in their behavior, the human beings had very little power and could hunt only the smallest of animals, hares, ptarmigan, the occasional raven, and they did not know how to live properly. Their only decoration was to wear the occasional anguak, an amulet made from a sea urchin shell. Women had joined the two men on the earth in this earliest of times. They came from the glaciers much as the men had come from the earth, but they were barren and spent all their time walking the coastlines, staring into the sea, or digging into the ground in search of children. The second cycle of the universe appeared after a long and bitter contest between a fox and a raven. The seasons appeared then, and then life and death itself. Shortly after the seasons arrived, a new era began, in which the life spirit of human beings would die with the bodies, and the Inua spirit would travel elsewhere. Shamans learned some of the secrets of the cosmic order then, and were able to help the real people learn how to live properly, creating rules which forbade incest and marrying out of the family, or murder, or other behavior which goes against the order of things. The shamans were also able to see back even into the time before Akulu Jusi and Umanirtuk crawled out of the earth, and to explain to the human beings about the origins of the great spirits in the universe, the Inuat, such as the spirit of the moon, or about Najuk, the spirit of consciousness itself, or about Sila, the spirit of the air, who is also the most vital of all ancient forces. It is Sila who created and permeates and gives energy to all things, and who expresses her wrath through blizzards and storms. This is also the time when the real people learned about Sedna, who is known in other cold places as Uwinigumawituk or Nuliajuk. The shamans explained that all human beings, the real people, the redder-skinned native human beings who lived far south of the real people, the Ijirait caribou spirits, and even the pale people who appeared so much later, were born after Sedna, Uwinigumawituk, Nuliajuk coupled with a dog. This also explains why dogs are allowed to have names and a name soul, and even share their master's Inua. The moon's Inua, Aningat, had incest with and otherwise abused his sister Siknik, the Inua of the sun. Aningat's wife, Ulilarnak loved to disembowel victims, animal or real people, and so disliked the shaman's meddling in spirit matters that she would punish them by making them laugh uncontrollably. To this day, the shamans may be seized by uncontrollable laughter and frequently die from it. The real people enjoy knowing about these three most powerful spirits in the cosmos: the all-pervasive spirit of the air, the spirit of the sea, who controls all animals who live in the sea or depend upon the sea, and the final member of this trinity, the spirit of the moon. But these three original Inuit are too powerful to pay much attention to the real people, or to human beings of any sort, since these ultimate Inuit are as far above the many other spirits as those lesser spirits are above human beings. So the real people do not worship this trinity. Shamans rarely try to contact these most powerful of spirits, such as Sedna, and content themselves with making sure that the real people do not break taboos that would anger the spirit of the sea, the spirit of the moon, or the spirit of the air. But slowly, over many generations, the shamans, known as Angakuit among the real people, have learned more secrets of the hidden universe and of the lesser Inuit spirits. Over many centuries, some of the shamans have acquired the gift that Memo Moira called the second sight, clairvoyance. The real people call these abilities Kaumanik or Angakua, depending upon how they manifest themselves. Just as human beings once tamed their cousin spirits, the wolves, to become dogs who shared their master's Inua, so did the Angakuit, with the hearing thoughts or sending thoughts gifts, learn how to tame and domesticate and control the smaller spirits who appeared to them. These helping spirits were called Tuwerngait, and they not only helped the shamans see the invisible spirit world and look back to times before human beings, but also allowed them to look into other human beings' minds to see the faults committed by the real people when they break the rules of the universe's order. The Tuwerngait, helping spirits, aid the shamans in restoring order and balance. They taught the Angakuit their language, the language of the small spirits, which is called Irinaliutit, so that the shamans could address themselves directly to their own ancestors and to the more powerful Inuit powers of the universe. Once the shamans had learned the Irinaliutit language of the spirit helper, Tuwerngait, the shamans could then help human beings confess their misbehavior and faults, so as to cure diseases and to restore order out of the confusion that is human affairs, thus restoring the order of the world itself. This system of rules and taboos passed down by the shamans was as complex as the crisscross string patterns created between the fingers of real people women to this day. The shamans also acted as protectors. Some minor evil spirits roam among the real people, haunting them and bringing bad weather. But the shamans have learned how to create and consecrate a sacred knife and to kill these Tupilait. To stop the storms themselves, the Angakuit found and handed down a special hook that can cut the Silagik Saktuk, the vane of the wind. The shamans can also fly and act as mediators between the real people and the spirits, but they can, and frequently do, also betray the trust of their own powers and harm human beings by using Ilisiksinik, powerful spells they cast which stir up jealousy and rivalry, and which can even create a hatred sufficient to compel a real person to kill others for no reason. Frequently, a shaman loses control of his Tuwerngait helping spirits, and when that happens, if it is not remedied quickly, that incompetent shaman is like a large metallic rock calling down the summer's lightning, and there is little choice except for the real people either to bind up the shaman and leave him behind, or to kill him, cutting off his head and keeping it separate from the body so that the shaman cannot bring himself back to life and pursue them. Most shamans with any power at all can fly, heal people, families, and entire villages, actually by helping people heal themselves, by finding balance again after confessing their faults. Leave their bodies to travel to the moon or to the bottom of the sea, wherever the Inuit most powerful of spirits might dwell, and after the proper Irinaliutit shamanic incantations, singing, and beating of drums, turn themselves into animals, such as the white bear. While most spirits who are not contained in souls are content to dwell down in the spirit world, there are creatures abroad who carry the Inua spirits of monsters. Some of the smaller of these monsters are called Tupilek, and were actually brought to life by people called Ilisituk hundreds and thousands of years ago. These Ilisituk were not shamans, but rather evil old men and women who learned much of the shaman's powers, but used them to dabble in magic rather than in healing and faith. All humans, and especially the real people, live by eating souls. They know this well. What is hunting but one soul seeking out another soul and willing it into the ultimate submission of death? When a seal, for instance, agrees to be killed by a hunter, that hunter must honor the Inua of the seal who has agreed to be killed, after it is killed, but before it is eaten. Since it is a creature of the water, by giving it a small ceremonial drink of water. Some of the real people, hunters, carry small cups on a stick for that purpose, but some of the oldest and finest hunters still pass the water from their own mouths to the dead seal's mouths. We are all eaters of souls. But the evil Ilistuk, old men and women, were soul robbers. They used their incantations to take control of hunters, who often then took their families away from the village to live and die, far away on the ice or in the interior mountains. Any descendants of these victims of soul robbery were known as Kivitok and were always more savage than human. When families and villages began to suspect the old Ilistuk of their evil, the sorcerers would often create small evil animals, the Tupilek, to stalk, injure, or kill their enemies. The Tupilek started out as lifeless things, as small as finger stones, but after being animated by the Ilistuk's magic, they would grow to any size they wanted and take on terrible, unspeakable shapes. But since such monsters were easy for their victims to spot and flee from in the daylight, the stealthy Tupilek usually chose to take the approximate shape of any true living thing, a walrus, perhaps, or a white bear. Then the unsuspecting hunter who had been cursed by the evil Ilistuk would become the hunted. Human beings very rarely escaped the murderous Tupilek once they were sent out to do their killing. But there are very few evil old Ilistuk sorcerers left in the world today. One reason for this is that if the Tupilek did not succeed in killing its assigned victim, if a shaman intervened, or if the hunter was so clever as to escape by his own devices, the Tupilek invariably returned to slaughter its creator. One by the one, the old Ilistuk became victims of their own terrible creations. Then there came a time, many thousands of years ago, when Sedna, the spirit of the sea, became infuriated with her fellow spirits, the spirit of the air and the spirit of the moon. To kill them, these other two parts of the Trinity that made up the basic forces of the universe, Sedna created her own Tupilek. This spirit-animated killing machine was so terrible that it had its own name-soul and became a thing called Tuunbak. The Tuunbak was able to move freely between the spirit world and the earth world of human beings, and it could take any shape it chose. Any form it took was so terrible that even a pure spirit could not look upon it directly without going mad. Its power, concentrated by Sedna only on the goals of wreaking havoc and death, was pure terror itself. On top of that,
Sedna had granted her Tuanbak the power of commanding the Itzik-Kusik-Juk, the innumerable smaller evil spirits abroad. By itself, one-on-one, the Tuanbak could have killed either the spirit of the moon or Sila, the spirit of the air. But the Tuanbak, while terrible in every aspect, was not as stealthy as the tinier Tupilek. Sila, the spirit of the air, whose energy fills the universe, sensed its murderous presence as it stalked her through the spirit world. Knowing that she could be destroyed by the Tuanbak, and also knowing that if she was destroyed, the universe would be thrown down into chaos again, Sila called on the spirit of the moon to help her defeat the creature. The spirit of the moon was not interested in helping her, nor was he concerned about the fate of the universe. Sila then beseeched Naajuk, the spirit of consciousness, and one of the oldest Inua deep spirits, who, like Sila, had appeared when the chaos of the cosmos had been separated from the thin but growing living green reed of order so very long ago, to help her. Naajuk agreed. Together, in a battle that lasted for 10,000 years and which left craters and rents and vacuums in the fabric of the spirit world itself, Sila and Naajuk defeated the terrible Tuanbak's attack. As all Tupilek who have failed in their assassination assignments are destined to do, the Tuanbak then turned back to destroy its creator, Sedna. But Sedna, who had learned all of her lessons the hard way, since even before her father had betrayed her so long ago, had understood the danger the Tuanbak posed to her even before she created it. So now, she activated a secret weakness she had built into the Tuanbak, chanting her own spirit world Irina Liutit incantations. Instantly, the Tuanbak was banished to the surface of the earth, never able to return to the spirit world, nor to the deep bottom of the sea, nor to hold pure spirit form in either place. Sedna was safe. The earth, and all its denizens, on the other hand, were no longer safe. Sedna had banished the Tuanbak to the coldest, emptiest part of the crowded earth, the perpetually frozen region near the North Pole. She chose the far north, rather than the other distant frozen areas, because only the north, the center of the earth to the many Inuit gods, had shamans there with any history of dealing with angry, evil spirits. The Tuanbak, deprived of its monstrous spirit form, but still monstrous in essence, soon changed form, as all Tupilek do, into the most terrible living thing it could find on earth. It chose the shape and substance of the smartest, stealthiest, most deadly predator on earth, the white northern bear, but was to the bear in size and cunning, as a bear itself is to one of the dogs of the real people. The Tuanbak killed and ate the ferocious white bears, devouring their souls as easily as the real people hunted ptarmigan. The more complicated the Inua soul of a living thing is, the more delicious it is to a soul predator. The Tuanbak soon learned that it enjoyed eating men more than eating Nanook, the bears, enjoyed eating man souls more than it enjoyed eating walrus souls, and enjoyed eating men more even than it enjoyed devouring the large, gentle, and intelligent Inua souls of the orca. For generations, the Tuanbak gorged itself on human beings. Large parts of the snowy north, that once were thick with villages, areas of the sea that once saw fleets of kayaks, and sheltered places that had heard the laughter of thousands of the real people, were soon abandoned as human beings fled south. But there was no fleeing the Tuanbak. Sedna's ultimate Tupilek could outswim, outrun, outthink, outstalk, and outfight any human being alive. It commanded the Itzik-Kusik-Juk, bad spirits, to move the glaciers farther south, making the glaciers themselves follow the human beings, who'd fled into green lands so that the white-furred Tuanbak would be comfortable and concealed in the cold as it continued to eat human souls. Hundreds of hunters were sent out from the real people villages to kill the thing, and none of the men returned alive. Sometimes, the Chuanbac would taunt the families of the dead hunters by returning parts of their bodies, sometimes leaving the heads and legs and arms and torsos of several hunters all mixed together, so that the families could not even carry out the proper burial ceremonies. Sedna's monster soul-eater looked as if it might eat all the human being souls on Earth. But, as Sedna had hoped, the shamans of the hundreds of groups of the real people huddled around the periphery of the cold north, sent verbal messages, then met in Angakuit shaman enclaves and talked, prayed to all their friendly spirits, conferred with their helping spirits, and eventually came up with a plan to deal with the Chuanbac. They could not kill this god that walked like a man. Even Sela, the spirit of the air, and Sedna, the spirit of the sea, could not kill the Talipek Chuanbac. But they could contain it. They could keep it from coming south and killing all of the human beings and all of the real people. The best of the best shamans, the Angakuit, chose the best men and women among them with shamanic abilities of clairvoyant thought-hearing and thought-sending, and they bred these best men with the best women the way the real people today breed sledge dogs to create an even better, stronger, smarter generation. They called these beyond shamanic, clairvoyant children the Siksam Yewa, or spirit governors of the sky, and sent them north with their families to stop the Chuanbac from slaughtering the real people. These Siksam Yewa were able to communicate directly with the Chuanbac, not through the language of the Chuangate helping spirits, as the mere shaman had attempted, but by directly touching the Chuanbac's mind and life soul. The spirit governors of the sky learned to summon Chuanbac with their throat singing. Devoting themselves to communicating with the Chuanbac, they agreed to allow the jealous and monstrous creature to deprive them of their ability to speak to their fellow human beings. In exchange for the Tupilek-killing creature no longer preying on human souls, the spirit governors of the sky promised the god who walks like a man that they, the human beings and real people, would no longer make their dwelling places in its northernmost snowy domain. They promised the god who walks like a man that they would honor it by never fishing or hunting within its kingdom without the monster creature's permission. They promised that all future generations would help feed the god who walks like a man's voracious appetite. The Siksam Yewa and the real people catching and bringing fish, walruses, seals, caribou, hares, whales, wolves, and even the Chuanbac's smaller cousins, the white bears, for it to feast on. They promised that no human being's kayak or boat would trespass on the god who walks like a man's sea domain, unless it was to bring food, or to sing the throat songs that soothed the beast, or to pay homage to the killing thing. The Siksam Yewa knew through their forward thoughts that when the Chuanbac's domain was finally invaded by the pale people, the Kabluna, it would be the beginning of the end of times. Poisoned by the Kabluna's pale souls, the Chuanbac would sicken and die. The real people would forget their ways and their language. Their homes would be filled with drunkenness and despair. Men would forget their kindness and beat their wives. The Inua of the children would become confused, and the real people would lose their good dreams. When the Chuanbac dies because of the Kabluna sickness, the spirit governors of the sky knew its cold, white domain will begin to heat and melt and thaw. The white bears will have no ice for a home, so their cubs will die. The whales and walruses will have nowhere to feed. The birds will wheel in circles and cry to the raven for help, their breeding grounds gone. This is the future they saw. The Siksam Yewa knew that as terrible as the Chuanbac was, this future without it, and without their cold world, would be worse. But in the times before this should come to pass, and because the young clairvoyant men and women, who were the spirit governors of the sky, spoke to the Chuanbac as only Sedna and the other spirits could, never with voices, but always directly, mind to mind. The still living God who walks like a man listened to their propositions and their promises. The Chuanbaq, who, like all the greater Inuit spirits, loves to be pampered, agreed. He would eat their offerings rather than their souls. Over the generations, the Siksum Yeyua clairvoyants continued to breed only with other human beings with the same skill. At an early age, each Siksum Yeyua child gave up his or her ability to speak with his or her fellow human beings to show the God who walks like a man that they were devoted to speaking only to him, to the Chuanbaq. Over the generations, the small families of the Siksum Yeyua, who live so much farther north than the other villages of real people, who are still terrified of the Chuanbaq, always making their homes on the permanently snow and glacier-covered earth and ice pack, became known as the God-walking people, and even their speaking family's language became a strange blend of the other real people's tongues. Of course, the Siksum Yeyua themselves can speak no language, except for the clairvoyant speech of Kwamanik and Angakua, thought-sending and thought-receiving. But they are still human beings. They still love their families and belong to their larger family groups. So to speak to the other real people, the Siksum Yeyua men use a special sign language, and the Siksum Yeyua women tend to use the string-shaped games that their mothers taught them. Before leaving our village and going out into the ice, to find the man I must marry, the man my father and I dreamt of, back when the paddles were clean, my father took a dark stone, Aumaa, and he marked each paddle. He knew that he would not return alive from the ice. We had both seen in our Siksum Yeyua dreams, the only dreams that are true, that he, my beloved Aja, would die out there at the hands of a pale person. Since coming off the ice, I've looked for that stone, in the hills and on the riverbeds, but I have never found it. Upon my return to my people, I will find the paddle on which the Aumaa made its grey mark. Birth was a short line at the blade tip, but longer and above this, death was drawn parallel. Come again, shouts the raven.